British Public Radio. Food and Drink.
Howdy and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and on this week's show we're talking with Mark DeVere. Mark is a master of wines and he works for Mondavi Wines in Napa Valley. We're going to be talking to Mark about Napa Valley wines, the geology, the climate and the changing style of Napa wines. We use that as an interesting point to discuss the ageability of Napa Valley wines. In the Scott household at the moment, in 3050, things are tootling along okay. Jane's been back now for a couple of weeks from hospital. It's starting to come right, I think. You know, she's still not 100% by any stretch of the imagination, but she looks good now and is starting to get stronger and stronger by the week. So hopefully it won't be too long before we hear Jane's voice on the news. But still this week, you've still got me. China's set to become the largest market of WSET wine courses. Whilst the number of UK Wine and Spirit Education Trust students increased by 11% last year, China has now overtaken the UK as the largest market for WSET training programs. China has 22 training centres and Hong Kong has a further 22. Ian Harris, WSET Chief Executive, told Harper's the WSET is on a course to grow a further 20% in the next year, following a 20% increase in the last year. People are more and more believing in the importance of education in their business, he added. He said the balance of students remain about three quarters from the trade and a quarter from the general consumers. And there's an increasing number of people doing WSET courses who are looking to start a second career in wine. That's how Jane and I got into the business. Well, in fact, 3050, our business, is a WSET-approved program provider. One of the things I find with WSET, it's quite hard to do the courses in a manner that's timely. When I did my courses, we did level 2 and 3, and we just rattled through them over 2 weeks, me and Jane. And it was pretty hard work because you're studying and tasting all day, cramming all night, and then the next day it was on again. So it was full on, very, very full on, in fact. Similarly, I've seen people do the course over almost a year of a couple of evenings a week, and that's just too slow in my opinion as well. So the way we do them is we do them on Saturdays. So if the level one is just one Saturday, the level two is three Saturdays in a row, and the level three is five Saturdays in a row. So we think over a short period of time you can get the courses but still have plenty of time to digest stuff during the week. Anyway, let's move on to the last news story, and it's a boycott from South African wine. South African wine trade are defending their corner again this week. The First Nations farm worker strikes have nothing to do with them, despite repeated union calls for further strikes and boycotts. And secondly, defending themselves against a poll in The Guardian. 59% said yes, they will. 41% said no. Sue Birch, CEO of Wines of South Africa, says in an open letter to The Guardian, the coverage unfairly targets South African wine industry and has the potential to do unimaginable damage to an industry that is working hard through its support of the Wine and Agricultural Ethical Association or, and also fair trade to ensure ethical treatment of workers. So, nothing to see here, move on. Although, if you've seen the shots on TV of the workers, they don't seem particularly happy about it. The pay rates, when you see them, are pretty awful. But by the same token, I don't know how the pay rates fit within the wider economy. So it's hard to say that just because someone's getting paid a fairly low rate, that it's not a fair rate for that type of work. And you don't know if the pay rate does take into consideration things like accommodation or food, because I know a lot of wineries do accommodate the workers. With an unemployment rate in South Africa, which is incredibly high, it's pretty hard to justify a 100% increase in pay, which is what the workers are trying to go for, when there's so much demand for work. It's a bit of a tough one, I know. That's why I don't really want to make an opinion, but it's interesting and something to follow. Okay, next up, we've got the spotlights. And this week's spotlight, we're just going to be looking at the poll question. And the poll question this week was, which glass size do you prefer to be served in a pub? Now, we've ran this poll a couple of times in 2008, 2010, and now January 2013. And for the January 13 results, a large glass, 250ml glass, which is large, 40% said they preferred it. A medium glass, 175ml, 50% said they preferred it. And a small glass, 125ml, 10% said they preferred it. Now, this year when we ran the poll, is another rise in the number of people who prefer a large glass in the pub. In 2008, 31% preferred a large glass compared 34% in 2010, and this year's 40% preferring a large glass. So Big increase there. The main loser has been the medium-sized glass, still the wine drinker's most favoured at 50%, but down from 49% in 2008. The small glass is pretty static, with only about 10% of the population actually liking a small wine glass. I feel many pubs do a disservice to wine drinkers. If you order a large glass, you get a 250ml pretty much in a 250ml glass. The ability to swirl and sniff the wine is impossible, and it removes a big part of what I like about wines. Especially in modern pubs, where now you can actually smell a wine now they're no longer smoky. I think pubs should only have one glass size, even if it's only a 250ml glass. That way, if you order a medium, say 175ml glass or 125 for a small, you can get it into a big glass and you can swirl it and enjoy the wine and really enjoy that. Hopefully reducing the amount of glasses required in the pub, which will improve the margins for the pub, but most importantly allowing people to enjoy the wine a lot more. It is also socially responsible, selling a better service by encouraging moderation. So I say, get rid of all your small wine glasses, medium-sized wine glasses. Just have a single glass, maybe with a couple of lines on it for 250ml, 750ml. Let people pour them. If they want a big glass where they can't enjoy the wine, they just want to guzzle it, fair enough. But if you're like me, you want a nice medium-sized glass, 175 and a 250ml glass, perfect. So a nice option for the connoisseur. And if you're wanting a small glass, a 125 and a 250ml, that's even better. Better for swirling and enjoying. Get rid of the small glasses and the medium-sized glass. Keep the small glass and medium-sized unit sizes, and let's enjoy the quality of our wines a bit better. As I said at the top of the show, we're going to be talking to Mark Devere next. He is a master of wine and based in Napa with Mondavi Wines. In the show, we get a feel for the geology and how that influences the climate. We also discuss the changes in style coming out of Napa, as well as those eye-wateringly expensive cult wines. I always think of Napa as a valley, but it's not a homogenous valley. It varies quite a lot.
There's a huge amount of diversity. You're absolutely right. And that's part of the fun and the interest of Napa, is that it's a pretty small area. From the south end to the north end is only about 35 miles. But within that area, there's a huge range of climates. And in the south
and
end.
And soils as well.
A huge range of soils as well. What causes the climatic influence and what's largely caused this diversity of soils is the geography and the location of Napa Valley. We're in Northern California. Napa's about an hour's drive, hour and a half drive north of the city of San Francisco, right on the northeast corner, as it were, of San Francisco Bay, or San Pablo Bay is the northern part of San Francisco Bay. And what controls the climate in California is this contrast, as it were, or a juxtaposition of being fairly far south. We're about 38 degrees north of the equator. So if you compare that to Europe, it's like the southern tip of Sicily or Andalusia in Spain. So much further south than some of the classic wine regions of Europe. So we have the potential for a lot of sunshine and a lot of warmth in that sunshine.
Yep.
However, the Pacific Ocean running down the coast of California, coming from the north, is a very, very cold water current. Summer even, the temperature never of the water never gets above 10 degrees Celsius. So right beside the water, there are very strong influences. It's cold air and fog. It's almost too cold to ripen wine grapes. You have to come inland a bit. And so Napa Valley is probably 30, 40 miles inland from the closest part of ocean. How much influence of that coastal fog and coastal wind comes into the vineyards, that is what controls, as it were, the temperature. Napa Valley runs, we usually sort of say north to south, but it runs parallel to the coast, which is a fairly distinctive factor in the geography of coastal California. Unlike what you think of in a lot of sort of high school geography classes, where you think of rivers flowing towards the ocean and so valleys flowing towards the ocean, coastal California, the valleys were formed by the ocean plate being pushed under the continental plate and pushing up these valleys parallel. And what that means is that the walls of the valley form a sort of barrier against the direct influence of the ocean. Now, right down in the south end of Napa Valley, you open up onto San Francisco Bay, and there's an area we call Carneros, or Los Carneros.
We were talking about that last week. That's part of Sonoma,
correct,
as well as
Napa.
Yeah,
indeed. It stretches over into Sonoma County. It's one of the few AVAs that stretches across county lines. And down in Carneros, you're not only close to the cold air of the ocean, of the bay, and the bay is like a little air conditioner. You can stand in the vineyards, look out across San Francisco Bay. On a clear day from some vineyards, you can see the city of San Francisco in the distance. And so that brings cold air. But also, you get south of the Mayacamas Mountains, which is the range of mountains on the west side of Napa Valley. And when you're south of that range of mountains, you get some direct wind coming in off the Pacific Ocean. So the south end of the valley, you can grow beautiful Pinot Noir, beautiful Chardonnay, these varieties that need that cooler climate. And in Carneros, in most sites in Carneros, it's too cold to even ripen Cabernet Sauvignon. However, when you start moving north, you go past the city of Napa, which is in the south end of the valley. And as you drive north up the valley, you move slightly further away from this coastal and bay influence, and it starts to get warmer. And by the time you get up to Stag's Leap District and Yountville and Oakville and Rutherford, these are areas famous for growing great quality Cabernet Sauvignon, yep. Those varieties that need a bit more heat.
I haven't had the Stag's Leap Cellars Cabernet Sauvignon, but I've tried the Chardonnay, and that's still got a nice backbone of acidity there.
It still has a nice backbone of acidity. Often, even wineries who are based further up valley will have separate sourcing for their fruit in the south end of the valley and in the Carneros region as well. I can't speak exactly for Stag's Leap wine cellars. Stag's Leap, though, is towards the southern end of the great Cabernet Sauvignon regions.
There is a river there. What is the river called?
There's a river called the Napa River.
Oh, nice and easy one then.
Nice and easy. And it flows sort of down the center of the valley. Sometimes you'll go there and there's not much of a river to see. It's fairly seasonal in most of the valley. By the time you get down to the south end in the city of Napa, there's water in it all year round, but it's very seasonal. Over the years, of course, over the centuries, the millennia, it's been an important part of the soil composition. And one of the types of soils that basically on the flat land in the center of the valley is river deposits.
Yep.
Very diverse mix of soil types, because some places the river set down lots of boulders and rocks and very free draining. Other places the river set down very, very silty, heavy clays. So yep. Some parts of the river deposits can be very good for grapes, but a lot of the river deposit area is not ideal for growing grapes in, just because the soil's too heavy and clay rich.
I would have thought clay soils would be quite good in California, actually, because it doesn't rain in California a lot. The big problem with clay is that if it gets wet, it's pretty hard to work and it holds water. Grapes don't like it. But clay soils often give a real richness to wine as long as it's dry. And California isn't known for the rain.
That's true. Carneros, for example, there are some pretty clay-rich soils, and there's some beautiful wines grown on pretty heavy clay soils in south end of the valley in Carneros. Those were soils, by the way, mostly formed, but they were originally under the bay, and then as those rolling hills have risen up above sea level, that's why they're often very shallow and full of clay and with a very hard clay layer beneath them. It can get difficult to manage clay soils in California because they often get waterlogged in winter when we get a lot of rain.
Yep.
And then when they dry out, there's often not a lot of water left in them. Typically, further up the valley, the ideal soils are often found right on the edge of the valley, what we call alluvial soils, which have washed down off the mountains over the millennia. Off when we get heavy rainfall in the winter, the creeks flood, and as they flow down the fairly steep hillsides, when it hits the valley floor, they sort of fan out. And so we often call them alluvial fans. And as those soils have been deposited like that, often towards the back of the vineyard, sort of against the hillside, is where the heavier gravelly particles get left. And then the softer, siltier, more clay soils get washed close towards the river. And we often find that those soils close to the hills with the gravelier soils, more free-draining soils, are often the best for what we want. Because what you want in California,
that's a bit like Margaux, isn't it? Margaux's got quite big, heavy, deep gravel.
Often, exactly. And so gravel is famous for a lot of the best sites in Bordeaux. And what you want in Bordeaux, what you want in Napa are soils that drain well in the winter when we get pretty heavy rainfall, but hold water deep down.
Okay, so you're getting lots of rain in winter, which is bad for clay, I suppose.
A lot of rain in winter, yeah, and often late into the spring. And what you don't usually want is that heavy water retention near the surface, which is going to give a lot of vigor and vine growth early in the season, early in the spring.
Obviously, Napa Valley, reasonably famous for their Cabernet Sauvignons and their Chardonnays. Anything else to keep an eye out for?
Well, I'd say very famous for their Cabernet Sauvignons. I'd say the Cabernet Sauvignon is the variety that has really put Napa Valley on the world map as an area that makes world-class wines. all the most expensive wines, if you want to use the market as a reflector of quality, all the most prestigious, most expensive wines from Napa are Cabernet Sauvignon. That's the variety that can really stand shoulder to shoulder with the great wines from around the world.
Looking at it, the more famous regions, things like Stag's Leap, Oakville, they're closer to the inlet. Is that generally true?
Closer to the south end of the valley, so yeah. Closer to the bay. Yeah. Although there are some beautiful wines made further north in the valley, all the way up to Calistoga and in the north end, tends to be a bit hotter there. And a lot of people like that style and like the richness and the potential for heat and warmth you get up there.
Do you find you start losing a wee bit of acidity there? The wines, you know, say they get rich.
That can sometimes happen, yeah. It depends a lot on the vineyard soil and the farming techniques. There are a few places in the far north of Napa where they start to get a bit of cooling replacement air actually coming in over Knights Valley and Alexander Valley way. So right at the very northern tip, the pattern changes a bit, and there's some slightly cooler areas. By and large, around Calistoga is probably the warmest place. But there's a big demand for wines with that softer style as well.
Yeah, I'm sure they're quite popular. Let's talk a little bit about ownership in the valley, in Napa Valley. Historically, I've always thought of Napa Valley as being a lot of small producers, but I think nowadays it's starting to become a bit more corporate, bit bigger producers owning more chunks of land. Is there a consolidation going on there?
Not much consolidation in the way we'd normally think of it. There are certainly some of the larger companies that have bought wineries in the valley, but there are still far, far more small wine companies there than there are wine companies owned by larger businesses.
Okay, so what sort of breakdown of, in terms of hectareage of family-run businesses or smaller boutique businesses versus the larger companies?
Oh, percentage-wise, I'm really going to be stabbing in the dark a little bit here. But I would say, in terms of land ownership, my guess would be 90% is owned by smaller owners.
Oh, really? That's quite high, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially for a region. Is that a function of the fact that bigger companies often produce more mainstream wines, whereas Napa is quite a premium region and the prices are high? Or what do you think is driving that?
Probably partly. It's an area that a lot of people who have made money in other businesses like to come
IT.
And buy IT construction or all sorts of things, like to bring some of their money up and buy land in Napa and start a small winery. To put things in perspective, as it were, in 1966, when Robert Mondavi Winery founded Robert Mondavi Winery and in some ways started the regrowth of the wine business in Napa, there were probably about 20 wineries in Napa in 1966. Today, we've got over 400 wineries in Napa Valley. So huge, as it were, complexity or diversity, lots of small owners. There's also quite a large amount of the hectareage, as it were, or vineyard land that's owned by growers who all they do is grow grapes and sell to wineries.
Yep.
So there's a lot of land owned by people who certainly don't make wine out of all their grapes, might not make any wine at all.
There's a few producers in Napa, you know, things like Screaming Eagle and a few of those other guys who make these outrageously expensive wines. They're not icon wines. They're trophy wines almost for the winemaker. I always think it's more of an ego trip perhaps than things. And you look at the prices and things like Screaming Eagle is often more expensive than Lafite, for example. But obviously they don't have the volumes that the big Bordeaux producers have and can command those high prices. Is that a movement that you think is going to continue? Because I know prices in Napa softened quite a bit about 4 or 5 years ago, but they seem to be coming back now from what I've been reading.
Yeah, we often refer to the wines you're talking about as sort of cult wines. These very beautiful, very high quality wines, but they've somehow captured people's imaginations and they're highly sought after. So those prices seem to be sustainable, as it were. And so they're driven as much by demand as they are by pricing policies of the different wineries. And I think it's a credit, as it were, a tribute to the quality potential of the wines that can come from there. I think there'll still be a lot of highly priced, highly sought after wines being made in Napa Valley because it has the potential to make wonderful wines. And even if you come down a few hundred dollars from those super high price, the Screaming Eagles of the world, I think there are wines that, relative to the prices that the great Bordeaux's are getting these days, it makes £90 a bottle, £100 a bottle Cabernet Sauvignons look pretty good value in terms of the quality that's being delivered compared to the price you have to pay for a really top quality bottle of Bordeaux these days.
Napa sort of sprung to life in the Judgment in Paris, 1976.
I'm
not an expert on Napa by any stretch. That's why I'm talking to you now, Mark. but I understand that the styles changed a wee bit since 1976. And I was wondering, do you think if there was a comparative tasting these days, Napa Valley wines would compete as well nowadays with a slight... Because they seem to be bigger and richer and less... elegant or less acidic, perhaps?
So they re-ran the tasting on the 20th anniversary. Oh, sorry, 30th anniversary, so 6 years ago. And the Napa wines were ranked very highly again. So I think, yes, we try not to...
With not the old vintages, but with new vintages.
Correct, with new vintages and with old vintages as well. So both in terms of how well the wines had aged and in terms of what's being produced currently. I trend not to position Napa as... overtly competing for quality with Bordeaux, although there's always some fun in doing those sort of blind tastings. But we also want to point out that we're different from Bordeaux. We're not trying to imitate Bordeaux. We're not trying to reproduce what they do, because we want to reflect our, most people I think in Napa would agree, we want to reflect our own origin. We want to reflect the flavors of place of Napa Valley. And I think often wineries have gone to a slightly richer style, but one of the great things about Napa is it's possible to make wines that still have a lot of freshness in the acidity. Napa tends to give beautiful tannins and this beautiful structure. And so while some people are definitely pursuing the sort of silkier, stylized way of making wines, which have a great market demand, there are still a lot of us making wines where we think you get beautiful freshness in the fruit flavors, beautiful crispness in the acidity, natural acidity, and wonderful tannin structure. So yes, maybe a little bit evolved understanding of what ripeness is, but there are a lot of people still making very classically structured, very drinkable, enjoyable wines, I think.
These wines that are a bit gutsier, or, you know, a bit more in there, ageability is always a concern. The more you get ripeness, the less you've got acidity often, and therefore, you know, you need acidity as a key driver of ageability.
Yep.
Do you think that the wines will age as well these days as they did maybe 30, 40 years ago?
Some yes, some no. I think the wineries that are focused on making wines to age and have great vineyards and good track records, and if I might refer, you know, the wines I work with most closely with at Romp Darby Winery, they're still coming in at the same pH level, a bit more ripeness in the fruit flavors maybe, but still really good pHs. So the acidity that's, I think, important for aging, as you say, is still strong in there, the density in the fruit. And I think some of the great Napa Cabernets are still going to age happily 30, 40 years. There are some wines, and I think probably their stylistic goal is not to age for a long time.
Yep.
That a lot of people don't age wine anymore. A lot of people are content with 10 years of aging, and the wine's evolved enough by that point. And so there are definitely some wines who I think they would say they don't even care that they're not going to age, because it's about delivering a lot of pleasure immediately in the short term, as it were. Not everybody wants that long-term aging. For those who do, there are undoubtedly some Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignons being made that will still go for the long haul and will age a beautiful long time.
When you say long haul, do you mean 40, 50 years?
When I say the long haul, not forever, but 40 years. I'm confident that some of the top Napa Cabernets being made now will easily go 30 or 40 years.
I heard a quote yesterday, which I love, and I might use it. We finished the show with a quote, and it went something along the lines of, there are great wines... there are great wines that age, but very old wines are just memories.
That's often the case. It's you often find yourself tasting a wine and thinking, oh, I wish I'd had this 10 years ago, as it were. And it's often a sort of memory of what it could once have been. But
yeah. Okay. And just one last wee thing on aging. What sort of flavor profile develops... you know, the bouquet of the wine over time, you know, because each region has their own sort of idiosyncrasies with that.
I think, well, the great Cabernet Sauvignons tend to take on a character that's typical of maturing Cabernet Sauvignon-based wines, so maybe more of the earthy characters, those sort of foresty characters. Often with time, that rich berry fruit that you see in young Cabernet Sauvignons gradually starts to integrate and evolve. Often around about 10 or 15 years of age, the wines start to shift so that, as it were, the balance in your perception is going to be more on the level of those earthier, sometimes meatier characters, but they still keep that suppleness and sort of sweetness of the fruit in the mid palate, even when they're not essentially fruit flavored anymore, or the fruit flavors are not the most important characteristics. And then the tannins also evolve and become more integrated and softer, and beautiful wines. I was fortunate to enjoy a 1979 of Cabernet Sauvignons last night, and everyone was suitably impressed at how delicious it was tasting, if I might brag for a moment.
No, please do. It's fine, Mac. Okay then, Matt, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Fun talking with you, Chris. Thanks.
Cheers, bud. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a British Public Radio presentation in association with the wine tasting company 3050. For more, go to 3050.co.uk.